Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining What Mama Wants. I kind of think Mother Earth wants less toxics and more health. This is a chance to hear from educators, citizens, policymakers, and scientists about the role toxics are playing in our daily lives, like PFAS, plastics, and phthalates. And we always wonder what Mother Earth wants while we're at it. My guest today is Mark Hyland. He's the retired Bureau Director for Maine's Department of Environmental Protection and headed up the charge to clean up toxics in the region's designated Superfund sites. I'm delighted to have you on the show today, Mark. Thank you very much for being here with me.
Thanks, Kate. I'm glad to be here.
Well, good. I promised people on Instagram that we would make it fun. We're going to talk about toxics. It should be really fun. Superfund is a super cool name that the EPA came up with in 1980. Sounds like you're all a bunch of accountants wearing capes and bending rebar with your bare hands. But in fact, Superfund is a nickname for the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act of 1980. I wondered if you could tell us some of the qualities that makes an abandoned waste site qualify as a nationally recognized toxic disaster or Superfund site, and what are some of the chemicals you end up cleaning up?
Sure. Yeah. So the folks that work in this part of the law, I always call it CERCLA because they love acronyms, and that's one of the best ones because nobody can actually say comprehensive environmental liability and all that other stuff. And so the qualities that make up a Superfund site are generally that some sort of hazardous chemical has been disposed of or dumped on the site or has been released in some fashion. And it's contaminated people's water supplies, maybe the air nearby, and certainly the ground. But usually, if you look around main sites, generally what they did was they contaminated groundwater in some fashion. And the reason that's important is that about half of, a little over half, actually, of the people in the state of Maine get their water from well water. Wells drilled right on their property. And so our Superfund sites show up because we've contaminated some of that groundwater that people come to depend on. And sometimes it's surface water, sometimes it's groundwater, but it's generally a water contamination situation.
Are Superfund sites always abandoned? I mean, can you have a Superfund site where a company's pumping out the chemicals now?
You can. And in fact, three of Maine's Superfund sites are military sites: Loring Air Force Base, Brunswick Naval Air Station, and also Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. All of those facilities were in operation, and also Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. All of those facilities were in operation when they became Superfund sites. And in years since, both Loring and Brunswick were part of the Defense Reauthorization Act, and they were actually closed. But Portsmouth Naval Shipyard is a Superfund site, and it's still an operating shipyard, and it's actually the oldest military facility in the world, or in the United States at any rate. And yeah, you can have those situations. In fact, those of us who work in Superfund prefer that situation because it means that the responsible party has the lead. They're the ones that have to make things happen. They're the ones that have to do the cleanup, and they have to do the evaluation and things like that under our supervision. And that's actually the best situation because it means you're not putting huge amounts of people power and a lot of time and energy into dealing with the site.
So what are some of the ones that have been abandoned, old industries that we're no longer doing?
Yeah, some of my favorite, tough word to use on a Superfund site, right?
My favorite toxics.
Yeah. From the start to finish, one of my favorites was the Eastland Woolen Mill in Corinna, Maine. It was a really good example of that. The mill building was enormous. It covered the entire downtown of the town. And it was a woolen mill. They took wool sheared off of sheep and wove it into fibers and then wove it into blankets and things like that. It was still in operation, actually, just shortly before it became a Superfund site. And in the process of dyeing, they released a lot of volatile organic solvents, which is usually what puts something on the Superfund list. They dumped them directly into the river, and that caused contamination below the base of the river, about 40 feet deep into bedrock, and contaminated everybody's water supply in town. All of the downtown area was contaminated. An odd story there: it was discovered by a DEP employee driving through town, Norm Marcotte, who just happened to be stopped for lunch in the diner and took one drink of water and said, "Oh my God, what is wrong with this?" So he took a sample back to the lab and had it analyzed, and we were notified shortly after that what the problem was. So
it's a tricky way to find a Superfund
site.
Yeah,
one of the hallmarks of volatile organic contamination is that people lose their sense of smell, and so if they've been smelling it or drinking it for a long period of time, they get desensitized to it and they don't even notice it's there. I mean, it took somebody, you know, an educated person from our agency to actually spot the problem, and we were able to do something about it after that.
Was their water also colorful?
It was colorful. In fact, the sediments that we dug up in the bottom of the river were all sorts of shades of red and blue and purple. It was pretty wild.
I've heard in my town of Kennebunk that there was a factory that dyed leathers up in Sanford, and that every day the kids would run down to see what color the bubbles in the river were that day.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, go Superfund. So what are the common contaminants that you're cleaning up at most of these sites?
Yeah, there's a whole range. It can be something as simple as lead in the soils to things like PCBs, which are chemicals that were originally added to transformer oils to keep the transformers cool. We have at least three or four sites where we had PCB contamination that was pretty serious. And PCBs are a real hazard in that they're carcinogenic at pretty low levels. So that's one of the reasons why sites like that become Superfund sites. In our case, many of our Superfund sites are junky. They're all old recycling facilities that cracked transformers and did something like that. There's also the solvents, the volatile organic compounds that we see, trichloroethylene, perchloroethylene, things like that. They're used as solvents for things like parts washers in automotive and aviation repairs. They're used to keep things from, they're sort of rust preventers in a lot of ways. But when they get into the ground, they create a real problem in groundwater because they sink in the water. They don't mix with water, much like oil doesn't mix. Oil at least floats on top of the water, which makes it, in some cases, a little easier to clean up. But these dense non-aqueous phase liquids, when the solvents sink into the groundwater table, they're very difficult to extract. And it means that people's water supplies can be contaminated for a very long time because we don't have really great methods for pulling those contaminants out of the groundwater.
Can you tell us presently how many Superfund sites are recognized in Maine?
Sure. There's 17. Some of them, I think, there's two or three of them, I think, that have been delisted recently because they've reached the end of their completion, end of their cleanup process. But 17, which sounds like a lot, but we have hundreds of state uncontrolled hazardous waste sites that in many ways are very similar to Superfund sites. They just haven't reached the scale that a Superfund site does. Some of the Superfund sites are small, but they have big problems. Others are quite large and, you know, cover a large territory.
What's the average amount of time it takes to clean up a site?
Yeah, boy, I wish I had an answer for that one. Typically, it's a long process. It may take, if we're rushing to a solution, if we have a real critical situation at a Superfund site, it may take us a year or two, sometimes three, to actually evaluate the situation to see just how bad it is. And then we have to go through the process of actually doing the cleanup. And that takes, we have to look for various solutions. It's not a one-size-fits-all sort of thing. Each site's a little different. So you could go from beginning to end, you could spend 10 or 15 years actually cleaning up a Superfund site. It's a long process. And it's frustrating for both the people that do it and the citizens that live in the nearby community that have to watch it.
What do they find frustrating?
Well, the speed. I mean, people think of it as a simple process. Well, why don't you just clean up all the waste? Well, yeah, that's easier said than done a lot of times.
So much easier said than done, right?
Yeah,
like, why don't we make choices to not use these chemicals rather than use them and figure out how to clean them up later?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's one of the problems with how we do sort of public policy things. We end up with the problem first and the solution later on. And it would be good. I mean, so for example, when PCB oil was invented, everybody thought, well, this is fabulous. You know, we're going to be able to cool electrical equipment much easier. We'll put it in everything because it'll work much better. And so PCB oils got put in all sorts of things. Even the fluorescent lights overhead, the little ballasts that fluorescent lights have PCB oil in them. So it was done, you know, because it was a great, seemingly a great product. But now, of course, we're living with the results of that. And it would be better if we studied the chemicals up front and then, you know, decided whether they were safe or not before we went ahead and used them. But that's not the way it works.
Not in the U.S.
No.
I think in Europe they do that, right?
Yeah, they do that in Europe.
Prove it. It is safe before you use it. Here, you're innocent till proven guilty.
Right.
Right.
That's the way they do it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Can you give us an example of exactly how you go about cleaning up any of these chemicals? I think it's kind of fascinating. It's hard for me when I picture, say, PCBs in the bottom of a residential well. I can't even imagine how you get that out. And how do you clean up soil that has toxins in it?
Yeah. We've tried a lot of different methods over the years to eliminate contaminants. And sometimes with oil, we're able to mix it and land farm it, basically get it to volatilize into the atmosphere and get these soil microbes to actually eat a lot of the contaminants. That works on some things. Some of the, you know, more volatile solvents, they will off-gas over time, but when they're at the bottom of the water table, they don't off-gas very quickly. And they really get soluble very slowly, so it's difficult to deal with. In many cases, we've learned that we call it muck and truck, basically, but it's you dig it up and try and consolidate the contaminants you have and either landfill them or send them to an incinerator or some sort of a destruction process. Many times with oil spills, for example, we would use it to make asphalt out of for road paving. And that was one of the best reuses we had for getting rid of contamination like that.
I heard that they're thinking of taking old football fields that are made out of plastic and turning them into pressed fence posts.
I suppose that's possible. It's difficult to, you get a breakdown over time when you reuse plastics over and over again. But there are lots of innovative things you can certainly try to, use those things in a way that works.
I think it's really cool that microbes can get involved.
Yeah, and they do. They're very good on lighter end petroleum products. They work very well. Sometimes on solvents that are lighter end contaminants, you can get microbes to work pretty effective. But you have to get the stuff out of the ground first, and that's the difficult part.
Yeah, the dig, then truck, then muck.
Yeah.
I found out about a lot of Superfund sites on EPA.gov. I found it to be a really user-friendly, exhaustive list of Superfund sites, and I would just direct traffic there if anybody's interested in seeing how close you might live to a Superfund site.
Yeah, it's interesting. They are all over the state, from far northern Maine to far southern Maine. Some towns have two, and you may not even know it. But that's, they're spread far and wide, and we go as far east in the state as Medibemps, and as far south as Saco, and as far north as Washburn. So.
Yeah, I think before I buy a house in the future, not that I'm looking, I would definitely swing by the EPA.gov and see how close that house might be to a Superfund site. I wonder what you wish people knew more about Superfund. You've been living in the Superfund world, managing it.
It's a government response, to bad situations. And just so you get some background on the sort of history of how we got to Superfund. Back in the 70s, 60s and 70s, we have these things called midnight dumping. And you'd hear about it in the newspapers and on the TV and stuff. People would say, these tankers, trucks arrived in a gravel pit one night and then they were gone and there was this bad smell afterwards. And it was true. Many chemical companies, many, fly-by-night operators were getting rid of their waste chemicals by just dumping them, either putting them in tanker trucks and releasing them as they drive down the road or dumping their drums off in an empty field or something like that. And the response to that was the federal government and Congress passing the Resource Conservation Recovery Act in 1976. And RCRA was kind of one of the first federal laws that required, sort of went backwards into time and required people to be responsible for their waste from cradle to grave. And it was a great thing, but it was tough on people in the early going because they didn't think that laws could go backwards. Usually when the law passes, everything starts from there. But environmental laws don't work that way, and CERCLA doesn't work that way, and neither does RCRA. And they actually go back in history and say, okay, if at some point in the past, even when it was legal or at least not illegal, you're going to be made responsible for cleaning up your messes. And so that's how RCRA started. And then Superfund in 1980 followed on when we had a series of things that included, things like the Valley of the Drums, Love Canal. There were a number of incidents where facilities were creating health problems for people that live nearby. And so Superfund was created in 1980. And along with the CERCLA part was the Superfund. And that's why people sort of get the two things, they jam them together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that is that there was a tax on the chemical and petroleum industry that required them to pay for the orphan sites, the sites that didn't have responsible parties any longer. And so there was a tax that went from 1980 till about 1995 when Congress sunsetted the tax. Tax raised millions and millions and millions of dollars and was the impetus really for us to get a lot of the Superfund cleanups completed.
Yeah. And we were talking about the right to know law, and I thought, wow, this kind of sounds like we have a right to know if our neighbor is a pedophile. Similarly, there's a right to know law that's come into place. Could you share a little bit about that?
Sure. And again, it's a reaction, but it was a good reaction. Probably it's ancient history now for most people, but back, it was about 1984, I think, in Bhopal, India, the Union Carbide plant had a massive leak of a chemical, an airborne chemical, that killed about 4,000 people, I think. And so Congress looked at that and said, well, this could happen here. There's no reason why this couldn't happen here. And so we have a responsibility to make sure that our citizens know what chemicals are being stored near their homes. So EPCRA became part of that, yet another acronym, and that's the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act. And it's part of Superfund.
And can you access that through the EPA.gov?
You can. You can look, type in EPCRA, and you can find the act right there. But what it does is this. It requires communities to plan if there's a chemical release in the community. And it provides money for that. And in fact, the businesses that are in the community have to actually fund that. It allows people to know by asking government, either their local fire department or the state agency that's responsible. In this case, in Maine, that would be MEMA, or Maine Emergency Management Agency. You can ask those agencies, well, look, I just moved in or I'm thinking of moving in. Tell me what chemicals are near my house. And so you can get a whole list of those things. And there's a bunch of different categories. In most cases, the reportable quantities are like 10,000 pounds or something like that. But in the extremely hazardous range, they can be as low as 100 pounds. So if you had 100 pounds of ammonia or 500 pounds, depending on the type of facility you had, you actually have to report that to the local fire department so they know what's going on.
It'd be good to know if you're living next door.
Yep.
Yeah. So if you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to What Mama Wants, which is less toxics and more health. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Mark Hyland, who's the former Bureau Director of Maine Department of Environmental Protection. And he's filling us in on Superfund sites, whose job it is to clean up the land, air, and water at abandoned toxic sites, and ones that are currently inhabited as well. I imagine that this work weighs heavily on the people doing it day after day, seeing polluted landscapes, thinking of what this means for the earth, and worrying about their own personal chemical exposures. I wonder if you could tell us about the people who do this work and how they cope with this day in and day out intensity.
Yeah, it does wear on people. But I have to say I was very fortunate to work with just some awesome people, both EPA and at the state level. The smartest people I ever talked to worked for EPA and the state in this area. I mean, it was people that many of them had lots of college degrees and long resumes, but frankly, they were really terrific at listening to people, hearing their concerns. And the best of them were very creative in some of the things that they were willing to do to clean up a site. And they always made sure they got back to people. And so it was a real joy to work with people like Ed Hathaway and Mike Nalipinski and a number of the people in the state, in our state agency, too, that were just terrific.
My guess is you had some pretty dark humor.
Yeah, there was some pretty dark humor. You see things, you think the gates of hell have opened up sometimes when you see the basements of some of these buildings and the stacks of leaking drums and things like that, and people's good humor was sorely tested at times.
I'm sure it was. And I think Mother Earth's good humor is probably being tested with our dumping habits. What do you think Mother Earth wants? What could we offer that would be a good guess?
Yeah, it's interesting that a number of Maine's sites were recycling sites. A lot of our Superfund sites, a lot of our hazardous waste sites, recycling sites where people thought they were doing the right thing. And it ended up being just creating another problem. And so I guess what I would say to people is to take a look at the products that you use and make some decisions. Probably one of my earliest environmental moments was back in the early 70s in high school when, I suggested to my mom that, Teflon coating on pans didn't look like a good idea to me, because anything that you could scrape off with a knife or with a spatula just looked like a bad choice. You know, when what's in that stuff anyway?
And you were very ahead of the game there.
Well, you know, ahead of the game, but it's interesting that behind at the same time, because even off after all of my Superfund experience, when we first started talking about PFAS at some of the bar military sites, I thought to myself, nah, this isn't much of a problem. How could this be much of a problem? I mean, we're reporting things in the parts per trillion and parts per quadrillion. This really can't be a big deal. Well, I was wrong. Yeah, I was wrong in a big way.
Do you want to explain what PFAS is?
Yeah, sure. It's perfluorinated alkyls and polyfluorinated alkyls. Anything with fluorine in it, you can generally depend on being probably not so good for you. Fluorine acid is bad. Fluorine gas is bad. And you can imagine that any chemical made with it is probably not a good idea. It has some interesting characteristics. It makes things very slippery. It makes things grease resistant. It does a great job of throwing rain off and things like that. But it remains in the environment forever. And the breakdown just takes so, so long. So not a great product. And I think that I think you had Gail Carlson on not long ago to talk about ski wax. It's everywhere. It's in everything. I mean, you can see these PFAS chemicals in Gore-Tex jackets, the Teflon pan on your stove, the finish on your couch in your living room, and spread on ski wax and the wrappers for your fast food and everywhere else. And so you really, if you want to avoid chemical exposure in many ways, make sure you do a few things. Make sure you test your water first. Well, like I said earlier, more than half the people in the state depend on their groundwater for water supply, and you need to test your water on a regular basis. I suggest to people test every couple of years. And you should test for a broad range of things, not just the metals, but you should be looking at to see if you have any pesticides or herbicides or organic compounds that shouldn't be there in your water.
Splurge on the test. And if you don't have money for it, there's money at the state level to help you test.
There is money available at the state level for people to do that. So I recommend that. The other is, don't imagine that naturally occurring elements are good for you. Radon, arsenic, manganese, things like that. Those are all bad things in your water, whether they're naturally occurring or not, and you shouldn't be taking them. So those are the sorts of things I'll tell people. And you have to make choices. I use cast iron cookware. I know it's heavy, but you know there isn't any PFAS on it. At the same time, though, I make choices too, just like everybody does. Yeah. I've got a closet full of Gore-Tex jackets, and I'm not willing to quite give them up yet. But if something better comes along, I'm listening.
That's right. So we're getting close to the end of the interview, and I wondered if I could ask you a couple quick questions with rapid fire here at the end.
Okay.
Get us back on ground. I wonder what your favorite thing to do was when you were a kid out in nature.
Oh, my mom would be horrified for me to tell these stories, but I was, you know, one of those sort of junior scientist guys. I loved to bring home frogs and snakes and salamanders and things like that. And more than once, my mom had to, you know, send me back outside to empty my pockets. So,
describe a scene in nature when you have felt awe.
Boy, you know, I like to look out over the lake, and we have a camp up in Washington County, and I just love to watch sunset. It's really something. You see these loons sitting in packs out in the lake and calling and at night, and it's probably where I see a lot of awe.
What's one thing your mother taught you about Mother Earth?
My mom was good at asking questions, and so I guess I would say, you know, ask questions, and don't be afraid to ask questions. And kind of, there's no such thing as a stupid question, especially when you're dealing with toxics and environmental cleanups, because the question you ask may give somebody an idea that or a thought that they hadn't had before.
And one thing that you wonder about in nature with this curiosity?
Oh, wow. Yeah, boy, that's a good question. I'm not really sure what I would say. I wonder how toads and frogs and salamanders and amphibians survive the onslaught that they get from their skins and their outer sort of shells are so thin that the onslaught of chemicals and acid rain and things like that, I just wonder how they survive that. But,
yeah. And finally, what is your favorite baby animal?
My favorite baby animal? Wow. This, That's a good one. I don't really know how to answer. I guess I'm taken with baby toads. We have this park. We go to Rang Pond State Park for walks on a regular basis. And every once in a while, there's this explosion of baby toads. And they're no bigger than the end of your little finger. And they're, all of a sudden, you'll see a motion out of the corner of your eye. And it's like, whoa, I almost stepped on that one. But yeah, they're kind of cute. They're all just sort of large toads, only miniaturized.
Fit in your pocket pretty easily.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Mark, you found a way through a career that didn't even exist when you were studying chemistry and geology in college and in graduate school. And you've served your state with your unique ability to understand the science, the law, and the people in government-sponsored cleanups of toxic chemicals. Thus, you've kind of protected us and the whole ecosystem we depend on. So thank you so much for offering the world your gifts in this way.
Oh, thanks.
And thanks for being my guest today.
Yeah, sure.
It was fun.
My pleasure.
Who knew you could put the fun in Superfund?